usually in the past, you may have thought of giving as this nice extra thing that you do at the end of the year if you have a little money left over. What we want to suggest is that giving can come into the core of your organization, whether you're just starting or whether you've been around for a while.
Welcome to Learning Life.
And the thing that I've realized, from the CEO to the NFL football player to the janitor, we're our toughest critics and we're hardest on ourselves.
But you have to be willing to say and point out the things that need to be said.
The only way to grab somebody's attention is with a story.
Welcome to Learning Life with John Toda and another episode in our Vermont Local series. My guest today is Kate Williams. Kate is the CEO of 1% for the Planet, where she leads their mission to build and activate an alliance of businesses financially committed to creating a healthy planet. Before that, Kate was the executive director of the Northern Forest Canoe Trail, so she's been leading efforts to protect our planet for a long time. There's a ton we can learn from Kate about that and about leadership in a remote world, so let's get into it. Kate Williams, welcome to Learning Life.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
So very nice to have you on the show. And I always start with all of our guests on this local series to understand how you got to Vermont, what brought you here. So what was the genesis of your journey to Vermont?
Yeah, it's a great question for us Vermont livers. I hesitate to call myself a Vermonter because you don't get to do that until you've lived here a lot longer than I have. But I moved here in 2001, had grown up in New England outside of Boston, but then lived with my husband in New Mexico for 10 years. But then we definitely felt the tug to come back to more home territory. And honestly, it was a little bit by chance, lucky chance, great good fortune, but chance. I was working on a national project with the Trust for Public Land and was able to move my laptop from the New Mexico office to the Montpelier office. And that's what got us here. And we're so happy.
Yeah. And obviously, because of everything that you do for the environment and for the planet, it would make a lot of sense that having a base here in Vermont in the Green Mountains would be a good fit. Do you feel like the Vermont locale is kind of a good home base for everything that you do with 1% for the Planet? Is it kind of on brand for your message?
Very much so. And again, it's interesting because that wasn't at the outset, that wasn't intentional. You know, 1% for the Planet was founded out of Patagonia in California and then moved to Vermont simply because that's where the then CEO happened to be moving himself. But as it has played out, being in Burlington, which is where we now are, is ideal. It's really wonderful for us in so many ways.
Yeah. You get the best of all worlds here. And so for our audience, I mean, I think so many people have seen 1% for the Planet. They've seen the logo on lots of companies' websites and on their marketing because there's so many major companies involved with it. But for anybody who doesn't understand the mission, can you just kind of wrap it up for us and tell us what 1% for the Planet is all about?
Absolutely. So we exist to create a way for businesses and now individuals as well to make a commitment to which we hold them accountable to give their 1% to support, you know, our planet so future generations can thrive. So the way that works is that our, and I'll talk about it on the business side first, because then I can just add the asterisks around how individual works. But basically, businesses commit to giving 1% of their annual revenues or sales to environmental nonprofits. We bring them on as members, and then we advise them on how to do that giving and really help them to develop a giving strategy that's powerful, drives impact, helps them to tell a great brand story, helps them to engage their employees, all that good stuff. They do their giving directly based on the, you know, advising work that we've done with them, helping them to identify nonprofits. And then we certify that giving annually. So that certification is really powerful because it's a way that we are able to, you know, make sure that anyone bearing that logo has given at that highest level.
Yeah. And so when you look at it now, and I guess there's lots of different ways to tackle all of our environmental concerns and all of the things that we should be doing for our planet. When you look at it, do you see that this angle of really coming at it from the corporate side or even individuals, is that more effective than governments trying to do this and them trying to make the change? Is that kind of part of the mission?
Yeah, I guess I would see it as a both and. So our view is that nonprofits and you know, objectively, nonprofits play a role that no other entity, government or business, plays. So nonprofits can go where there's not a market. They can go where there's not a constituency. they can operate wholly in service of a mission to, you know, in our case, serve the health of the planet. And so in that regard, you know, it's our belief that we need entities to support nonprofits to be able to do that unique work. Those entities are often individuals and increasingly companies. Government definitely needs to do its part too, but I think we've seen the changing tides of government. And I will say, like, government absolutely needs to do its part because that's where you often can get at that wider, broader scale. But again, oftentimes it's the nonprofits who are either creating the space for that or creating the pressure to make that happen. So we really need all of them, and the nonprofits play a pretty key central role.
Yeah, and I know you said in one of our talks previously, I think the line that you shared with me was that it's basically like paying rent for getting to use the planet, which is a really interesting concept, right? Like, we all take advantage of the planet, we all use the environment, we build our businesses and our lives on it, and giving back to the planet is kind of an idea that shouldn't be as novel as it is, but right, it's like it should be just baked into everything we do, that we couldn't exist and run the operations that we all do if we didn't have a planet that we could thrive on.
Absolutely. And that quote, the paying rent to the planet, is from our founder, Yvon Chouinard, who shared that at 1% for the Planet Summit a few years ago. And it really is a powerful kind of core belief for 1% for the Planet, because really what we do is we take giving or philanthropy, and we, with our members, we sort of get into a conversation around, hey, like, usually in the past, you may have thought of giving as this nice extra thing that you do at the end of the year if you have a little money left over. What we want to suggest is that giving can come into the core of your organization, whether you're just starting or whether you've been around for a while. And it can be a way in which you really pay that rent, you know, essentially just take responsibility for the impact that we all have. So no matter how great your practices are, you're going to have an impact. So, you know, one level is just taking care of that. But there's so many other levels as well in terms of engaging your employees in sort of perceiving and feeling that giving back and doing good is part of their daily work, addressing really specific business issues in your supply chain, in your waste management, things like that. So it can really be actually a very direct business solution. And it can be a really powerful way to communicate purpose and commitment to your customers. So moving giving into the center is really making it a core part of how you do business, in the same way that you pay rent, in the same way that you pay payroll, all of those things, is a really important core to our model.
Yeah, and I think it's so cool too, because like you said, it's setting an example for all of your employees, all of your customers, who see that you just take that responsibility on as a business, and then that should trickle down to them in the same way. And so my question for you, I know you've explained this to me as environmental philanthropy, and is there a big gap between traditional philanthropy, companies making donations and contributions in more traditional styles, versus how much they're giving to environmental philanthropy like this? Do you see that as kind of being the challenge out there, that you need to kind of level that playing field a little?
Totally. So at this point in the United States, only 3% of total philanthropy goes to the environment. And that number has been kind of stuck right around 3% for, you know, at least a decade. And it is our humble belief that that's insufficient to the challenges that we face, and that I know so many of us are, you know, quite literally experiencing. And I will say that, you know, those who are most vulnerable are experiencing even more, vulnerable species, vulnerable people. So there are very real issues that need greater investment in the form of philanthropy. So that is a big kind of rallying cry for us, is how do we engage more entities, businesses, and people in seeing how and feeling clear about how they can give to the environment, broadly defined, to drive positive change.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an amazing stat. Only 3% of philanthropy goes to the environment. And it's something that it should be easier to move the needle on. And so I think the mission is so great. And obviously, we've been talking to Vermont businesses during this series, and entrepreneurs, people at different stages growing their businesses and dealing with some of those challenges of doing it in a smaller market in Vermont. You've obviously spearheaded an international movement, and you have people all over the world that are working with you, and you're operating remote with a lot of people. What's your organization look like, and are there challenges doing it it here in Vermont, or does it not represent much of a challenge for the way you operate?
Yeah, so our headquarters is in Vermont. About half of our staff is based here and half is what we call sort of permanently remote. And I would say we have had to learn how to do it well, but I think we have done that. And it's now a big part of who we are and sort of how we believe we need to operate. And that's shifted over the last 4 or 5 years. When I started, which was actually 7 years ago, we were a small team almost entirely based in Vermont in Waitsfield. And so we very much, like many organizations, walked into each other's or walked over to each other's desks and talked to each other and, you know, had in-person meetings and things like that. As we have grown, even before the past year of, you know, everyone kind of going into remote mode for at least a while, you know, even before that time, we started hiring remote staff just because, as, you know, a nonprofit with members all over the place, it has made logical sense that we would hire good people in locations where they could connect directly with our members. And I would say we learned some things through that. And the past year, when we all went fully remote, we really learned some things and learned how we had not maybe in some ways been getting as good at remote as we had thought. So one like small example, but that I'll share as a way that we've continued to operate now that we do have people kind of flowing back into the office in a kind of hybrid mode, is that one of the things we learned during the remote phase was our staff meetings, where we used to have a group of people in the office sitting around a table and then a screen of people on Zoom. We thought that that was doing a good remote meeting. When we switched to all remote, so we're all our own little tile on the Zoom screen, we realized that's way better and way more fair and way more equitable to all voices. And there's no kind of in-person conversation happening, of which we every now and then will ask, you know, the people on the remote screen to weigh in. So we made a commitment that even if people are in the office during a staff meeting, we will all go find a place and have a separate Zoom screen, because that's made it much more just fair and evened out the way that we have our conversations. So we do that for all meetings, which has been really great. So I would say in, you know, summer of 2021, we are always learning, but we've actually figured out a lot of ways to fully embrace the fact that we are a remote organization and to do it pretty well.
Yeah, and I've been on the receiving end of those Zoom sessions where you're the one big head on the screen, and it's really feels like you're missing out on something on the other side when everybody's sitting around a conference table having another conversation. And yes, yeah, so that's an interesting strategy of really having everybody at equal levels in a Zoom session. And so obviously you have a lot of experience. I know you went to the MIT Sloan School of Management and you're a certified coach. So leadership and management principles are probably very important to you. You've got a lot of strategies around that. What are some of the things while you're trying to scale an organization where people are all over the place, and even more so now where you may not even have the full 50% of the people in the office? What are some of the strategies as a leader that you're implementing to really keep people connected, to keep that culture? You're so mission-driven. How do you keep that culture growing even though you don't have everybody sitting in a room together with you?
We're still figuring it out. And I would say we have figured out some really good things. So one of the things that's been important to me, and this is something that kind of has threaded through my leadership, you know, really since I was an outdoor educator leading trips in the field, which I always feel like was like my greatest training, because it's like real immediate consequences to, you know, what you do or don't do. But so one of the things that's threaded through is, you know, really genuinely listening to what people need and are, you know, interested in. And so that's one. And then similarly, and they have to go hand in hand, being willing to let go of what you thought was the right way to go. And so you mentioned not being able to have everyone around the table in the same room. And one of the things that I've been really challenging myself to do and our leadership team to do over the last year is like kind of interrogate that. Like, we assume that that's always a better way to build culture and conversation. Is it? I don't know. Maybe not. And so given the fact that we just objectively are not going to have everyone in the same room because many of our staff live elsewhere in California and we're in different time zones and all of that, that's not an option for us except for on, you know, unusual occasions, like once a year during a staff retreat when we can get everyone here. So really just shifting the belief of like, we actually have to be able to build culture remotely. So we need to learn how to do that well. So, you know, that's been our kind of building and now starting assumption is that it's not better to have everyone in the same room in person. It's actually our reality, which we're going to make better, of having people in different places. So some of the things that we've done is just, you know, putting that assumption in place so that there's not this sense of this is second best, but more this is who we are, and who we are is pretty awesome. And so let's bring that to life. And then everything else is like super tactical things, like really actively encouraging people to G-chat and set up coffee talks with each other. And, you know, so really supporting that. And some of these actually are not, you know, they apply whether it's remote or not. So it's, you know, this is where it gets into interesting territory, because it's like our context happens to be mostly remote. And here are the good practices we use, but they could translate. So one is we've really doubled down on flex time, because it's has always been my belief, but even more so, if people are going to be working hard, if they're going to be working hard without some of the rewards of like engagement that you do get when you sort of are, you know, get to socially go see people at the office, giving people the autonomy to be flexible is really important. And for some people, they may choose to use their flexibility to say, my workday is 9 to 5 and I work a really like set schedule and that works best for me. For other people, they may want to go surfing at lunch because that gives them that burst of energy that gets them through the afternoon. And they actually, based on their particular account list, often have to be on the phone late because of time zone differences. So, you know, the list goes on, but flexibility and really, really like emphasizing it and demonstrating that we mean it has been something that we've really doubled down on. And fortunately, people are really taking advantage of it in great ways. So they then feel that if they're working remotely, they're not just stuck alone in their office at home all the time. They're figuring out how to make that work. So flexibility is key. We have a philosophy of management, and this is, you know, something that I would say we're in the definitely on the learning curve on, but we have, as we have grown, we have more people managing other people. So we have just more management roles. And so we have developed a philosophy of what good management looks like to us, everything from the some of the guiding principles to like some of the practices that we think are really important. And being really explicit about those, because we're all implementing them remotely, just, you know, seems really important. So just very practical stuff around meeting check-ins and agendas and things like that, so that people feel really clear. And then also, you know, the sort of broader guiding philosophy around that, that's intended to create that space for individuality with also that sort of common commitment to some ideals. So having things like that really clear, so that then people can trust the flexibility. So it's all connected. They can trust that they're part of something and having those connections. And typically we are an organization where everyone is checking in with their manager once a week, is meeting with their team once a week. So we have, you know, very clear structured meetings. The last of the top three that I'll share, and again, I could go on and go deep, but is one thing that we've implemented this past year that's been a really great success, and we're super psyched about it, is, you know, we heard about meeting fatigue. People were like, there's a lot of meetings happening, a lot of Zoom. And so we, the second week of the month, every month, we do what we call no mandatory internal meetings. And so everyone is completely authorized to opt out of any internal meetings that don't serve them best. They certainly can have meetings if that's a way that they move their work forward, but you know, everyone gets to just sort of negotiate on their own with their managers, with their teams, how they want to handle it, so that people can, you know, if they're on our brand and marketing team, they can have big uninterrupted chunks of time to work on projects, because that's what they're always hungry for. If they're on our business membership team, they can have more time to schedule member calls and some time to dive into their accounts and get them cleaned up or whatever. And also just a little more flexibility. So if they actually want to sort of maximize flexibility in a different way than they need to when they're obliged to attend other meetings, they have that. So it's been kind of a really nice like palate cleanse week for people. And we're actually kind of exploring if there are ways we can bring that in more regularly, not necessarily for a whole week, but is there a day or something like that that we do? So, you know, we're continuing to explore that, but that's been a really great addition.
Yeah, I love all three of those. And I think, like you said, they go hand in hand together, because flex time and having the ability to remove yourself from meetings on a particular day or a week, it kind of all relies on you having that good management structure and everybody knowing that there's trust there, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say actually just one other sort of overlay, which informs all of that, is like my deep belief that if we hire good people, which we are going to, and there are many good people out there to be hired, they want to do good work. They want to be treated like adults. They have lives that they are leading. And sort of minimal overstructuring and maximum clarity around expectations and outcomes so that people can engage with the work, engage with their team in the ways that adult, motivated, focused people do. And that creates great things happening.
Yeah. And it's a good point too. It's like you have to hire the right people. And if you made the decision based on the character and who they are, then you have to have that trust that they're going to behave the way that they're supposed to and get the job done. And I think it's great. It paints a picture of a lot of trust that you have in the organization amongst the management team and the employees. And I think it's what everybody's striving for, and that's what they want to create. And so I also wondering from your perspective with the environment, and you look at all the work that you've done across your entire career, when you look at it now, where do you think the biggest problem is with our environment, with our planet, and where would you like to see the most amount of philanthropy go towards? Is there one particular area that really sits out there as the biggest problem that we need to tackle?
Oh, that's like the big question, which is always so hard. And I would say, and my response has evolved over time, I would say kind of where I am these days is that the biggest problem is that not enough people see, either feel like kind of saying I'm environmentalist, which you don't have to say in order to give, but like feel like they don't identify with that, or who see that it's like a trade-off. Do I give to the environment or do I give to feed the hungry in my community? And I think what I see as the biggest challenge and therefore the biggest opportunity is for us to see the intersections where we are not trading off people for planet or vice versa. And 1% for the Planet has really been wrestling with this too. Like, how do we think about racial justice as a connected piece of giving to the environment? And where, you know, what does that look like? So an example of where we have addressed this is we now allow for donations or count in our certifying process donations to food banks, because many food banks are diverting food from the waste stream. So from grocery stores, from restaurants, that's still highly edible, but was previously getting just dumped and creating emissions that were contributing to climate change. So when it's diverted and then made available to communities and people who need food, it's a great example of environment and social, like 100% overlapping in a really meaningful way. And so I think what I see as the area where we need to do the greatest growth and expansion of our sort of giving and focus is those areas where, you know, we really can make those connections. Because I think that's how we start to get more and more people engaged in seeing that they can give to the environment without feeling like it's an either or when they're also considering social issues.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating point, because I was thinking that they're like mutually exclusive. You can't actually tackle both. You got to choose one or the other. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at it, that you can help the environment while tackling some of these social needs at the same time. And that's a really interesting perspective on it. And so for the future of 1% for the Planet, if you look out 3 years from now, what's the goal for the organization? Do you guys have some kind of big picture goal that you're shooting for, or some level that you're trying to reach?
Yeah, I mean, big picture beyond 3 years, you know, it's our belief that every business and every human should pay that rent to the planet. So we really, you know, would want to see 1% for the Planet be something as core to running a business as, you know, I used these examples before, you know, paying your rent or paying payroll or any of the other sort of business expenses that we all just understand are part of doing business. So that's the big goal in the 3-year phase, to sort of like put some numbers on that. Like on the trajectory that we're on, we would like to have at least 10,000 members globally. We currently have just over 5,000. So that it could even be, you know, we may even want to shoot a little higher than that. And with that, as like a, so many other things fall out of that. So if among those 10,000 plus members, more of them are bigger, we would then, you know, accelerate the amount of annual certified giving that we're doing, which that's where we drive impact. So last year we certified more than 30 million. So at least doubling, if not tripling that. So, you know, those are really the two biggies. There's many that surround that and contribute to that, but that's how we drive change. And so we just so believe that just keeping the positive pressure on that couldn't be more important.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you look at it globally, is there a concentration in certain parts of the world? Is it very concentrated in the U.S. right now? Or are you seeing that you're getting more traction in certain parts of the world and not enough in other areas?
Yeah, it's so exciting. We're now more than 50% outside of the U.S. That has shifted significantly in the last few years. We expect that tip to continue. The big areas outside of the U.S., Canada, Europe, France, where we have a licensed chapter, a kind of unique little model there, Australia, New Zealand, that area. And then we're seeing some increased growth in Japan. So, and the UK is a big area, and I need to mention that outside of the EU. So yeah, it's exciting. And we're seeing, you know, some nice concentrations of growth and then some new areas that are starting to pick up.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's great to see that you're getting that much traction outside of the U.S. and it's growing that much worldwide. And yeah, and so for all of our listeners and anyone who is not already involved with 1% for the Planet and they are inspired by this and they want to get involved, whether they're individuals or businesses, where do they go? What do they do?
Super easy. Go to 1%fortheplanet.org, all spelled out in letters. And there's a nice little join button right at the top where you can get some information and then, you know, take next steps from there. And then one other thing that I'll mention is, you know, whether or not membership is a fit for you, we are launching the 1% for the Planet Donor Advised Fund, which is a way that anyone, members or non-members, can make donations that can drive really powerful change, including, you know, through the investments in the fund as well as annual donations.
Oh, that's awesome. So 1%fortheplanet.org is the place to go and they can find out about everything there and start to contribute from there.
Yes.
Awesome. It's so great to see everything you're doing and really making your home base here in the Green Mountains and having such an impact around the entire world. I think it's an inspiration for every business owner or organization here that you can move the needle in such a big way, no matter where you are. So thank you for taking the time to come on here and share your story.
Thank you for having me.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here each week. As you know, we have a new episode that comes out each week. So wherever you're listening, be sure to subscribe, leave us comments. We love to hear from you guys. And until our next episode, happy learning. Hey everyone, John Tota here. I want to thank you for tuning into the show each week. We love our Learning Life community and are so grateful for your support. We'd appreciate it if you would take a minute to rate us and write a review for Learning Life wherever you're listening right now. Your ratings and comments help new people find the show so we can keep growing our community and bringing great interviews on the topics you care most about.